I'm Leah Simone Bowen, the host of Podcast Playlist on CBC. We're a podcast discovery show, and we love a great story. So each week, we highlight the podcasts we think you should check out.
The show is a classic.
Love how they select their topics.
It's great.
And from time to time, we're joined by some of the biggest names in podcasting.
My name is Jamie Loftus.
John Green.
I'm Michael Hobbs.
My name is Nicole Byer, and I have a podcast recommendation.
You can find Podcast Playlist on the CBC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts.
This is a CBC podcast.
There's this moment in my conversation with the actor Taye Diggs where we play him a little bit of his time on the Broadway show Rent. And it's an emotional moment, not just because of like nostalgia, but because Taye Diggs is grateful for everything that's ever happened to him, but he looks back on his career in sort of a bittersweet and complicated way. That's an honesty you don't often see, but Taye Diggs has a lot to say about the system that made him a star now that he's on the other side. That's coming up. Plus, check this out. Audiences show up at a theater for a performance of a Shakespearean play. Someone comes out and does a land acknowledgement before the show. But then the land acknowledgement just doesn't stop. It keeps going and going. And soon the audience realizes there's not going to be a Shakespearean play at all. Cliff Cardinal is the artist behind that bait and switch. And he'll be here to tell you all about it. I'm Tom Power. You're listening to Q. So let's talk about Taye Diggs. Back in the late 90s, early 2000s, Taye was a massive star. He was in the original Broadway production of Rent. That gets him into this film called The Best Man, which was not just a really successful film, but an important one too. The cast, folks like Terrence Howard, Regina Hall, Nia Long, all go on to have huge careers. It gets talked about as a film that helped bring black cinema into the mainstream. But here's the thing about Taye Diggs. He has a lot to say about that time in his life when he was a big star, and those feelings are bittersweet and complicated. At one point in this conversation you're about to hear, I asked him, you know, how he reflects on that whole time, and he says something really interesting, that he was the biggest black male star in the world for a while, but he also started to have suspicions that Hollywood only allows one black star at a time. And when his time was over, he felt like he was kind of brushed aside. It's a really powerful perspective you can kind of only get from someone who was on the inside of a world we rarely get to access. Taye is back starring in The Best Man, The Final Chapters. It's the miniseries sequel to the film. It's out now on the W Network here in Canada. Here is my conversation with Taye Diggs. How do you feel? We were describing your work as the best maniverse. How do you feel about that?
I like the wordage. That makes sense. It's bittersweet. You know what I mean? It's bittersweet. But I have to say, after watching the final product, meaning, you know, the Best Man final chapters, I really enjoyed it, and it did really well. So I can't say if it's actually going to be the end.
It's bittersweet because Final Chapters, of course, implies that this is the end of something that you've been doing that's been important work through your whole life.
Yes, 100%. 100%. That's, yes. Yeah. And it was just, it's always just great getting back together with the gang. You know what I mean? Because we literally have grown up with each other in life and our careers. So it's always... provides a sense of kind of security and safety whenever we all get back together, because we all know each other's, you know, movements and vibes and energies. So it's always really, really fun.
I want to talk a little bit about the cast a little bit later, but I want to go to something you said there, like the idea of growing up with characters. It's actually quite rare if you think about it. I mean, you might go back to a Broadway role, you know, years later, but it'll be the same role. You might revisit a character, but it'll be the same role. And it's very rare for you to take on a role, say in 1999, and then age along with the character and visit the character as they have aged along with you, you know?
Yes, this is true. This is true. And we feel, at least, like, you know, speaking for myself, I feel very, just really lucky, you know, very fortunate to have that opportunity to revisit the character that is, it basically is aligned with my own life experiences. So, excuse me, it's been really, really great.
When you say a character that's been aligned with your own life experiences, how do you mean?
As these characters get older, there are similarities between my own life and the character's situation as well. You know what I'm saying? Like relationship issues, you know, wondering, you know, why you're here on this earth, career, you know, kids, all of that stuff I'm dealing with in real life as well. So it wasn't a far stretch to play the character.
I want to talk about the reception the show got. And I read this when I was doing research for our conversation. The director and show creator, Malcolm D. Lee, said something about the best man films and TV shows that I wrote down here. I wanted to make sure I said to you. He said, "It is now more than ever that the world is craving to see what I've worked my entire career to show. Relatable, universal stories about Black people and their humanity. It has always been my mission to make African-American stories mainstream." Can you reflect on what he's saying there a little bit?
Oh, man. It's so interesting to hear him quoted like that, because I know him as like the goofy director. He's like a brother, and we make fun of each other and we joke around on set. It takes, you know, what you just said every once in a while to remind me just how great he is and how I should be so grateful to him for doing what he did. Because when we first came out with that first Best Man, there was nothing like that out. You know what I mean? And I remember reading the script and thinking to myself, finally something, a movie that has me in it.
Can you tell me more about what that means? A movie that has me in it. What does that mean?
Well, like before, you know, and unfortunately, you know, we're still struggling, but you know, when I was coming up, the Black movies were a specific thing, and it, you know, it was mainly based in stereotypes, or you were, you know, when you go to the movies, you see the Black character in a white movie. It was that cut and dry. So when I came across Best Man, it was it's so weird. It was like, wow, you know, it was like the skies opened up, and I was like, I need to be a part of this. I need to be a part of this. You know, that's all Malcolm Lee. You know what I mean?
I mean, I'm struck by what he says there, where he says, now more than ever, the world is craving to see what essentially I had to struggle to make back then.
Oh yeah, 100%. It's still, I mean, you know, I'm very thankful. I feel very blessed, but it was still a struggle just to do this. Still, like even to this day, the third installment, you know, it's like, you still gotta fight these battles with, you know, the networks, and you know, it's a shame how deep these issues can be when it comes to just something as simple as, you know, wanting to provide a product that people want. You know what I mean? It's a trip.
Yeah, it's easy to paint this in like, oh, look how hard it was, and it's so much easier now. But it's still a struggle. There's still systemic issues. There's still issues within the entertainment industry. Let's not skip to the rosy ending here.
No. It's a trip, and you know, and these issues will continue to reveal themselves until we actually figure out a way to deal with it from the core, from its core. You know what I mean? You know, these issues don't go away just by paying us a little bit more money. You know what I mean? Like it's deeper than that.
There's deeper rooted issues even outside of the entertainment industry, and just in how we relate to one another, in how the country is set up, in how the actual history of Canada and the United States is not actually acknowledged. We want to skip to reconciliation. We don't want to do truth and reconciliation.
I do have to say that the industry is a little bit, I feel like the world is way ahead of what's going on in the industry. For some reason, you know, change, you know, happens last in the industry. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
I still figured that out, but it is getting better. It is getting better. I will say that.
Did you have any idea that when you made the first film, the first Best Man film, because you did the first Best Man film and When Stella Got Her Groove Back, How Stella Got Her Groove Back, pretty quickly. Like they were pretty close together.
Yeah. I hope I don't get in trouble for saying this. What I've noticed is that when it comes to Black actors, there's always like, there's like the flavor of the month. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And I don't know who decides, but at some point, all of the agents, all of the casting directors, they like deem one Black person the it guy. And that it guy gets, you know, first crack at all the roles. So all that happened when I was the flavor of the month. You know what I mean? So, and it was awesome. It's awesome when you're in it. But then, you know, once I was able to step out of it and to watch, it was like, oh, wow, they don't really, wow. They don't really do white actors like this. You know what I mean? Like there's one, it's like just one. And then he's like the Black guy in all of the movies. Right now it's, I think, is his name Jonathan Majors? Like he's the dude now, you know what I mean? So that's another example of you know, how kind of twisted the system still is.
I mean, Tay, that's so interesting to me that when you're in it, you are thinking, oh, this is great. I'm getting offered all these roles. This is amazing. I'm getting these amazing opportunities. And only when, I mean, maybe the generous way to say it is when those opportunities are not coming your way, that you are, you turn around and you go, actually, hold on. Everyone only gets like 6 months here. And then they pick somebody else.
Yeah. And I'm, you know, I've been in this business a minute, but there are still aspects that I don't know. So I would love to figure out who decides what, you know what I mean? And where it starts, you know what I mean? Because it's fascinating.
Did you know that when those two films came out though, that they were, because they are regarded as, I mean, we were just talking about this in the context of The Best Man. They are regarded as like pivotal films in the history of Black cinema. And you were in two of them very quickly. Were you able to be aware of that? Like, were you aware that these films might be called groundbreaking or they might be called important?
Absolutely not. I kind of, I liken it to when I was doing Rent. It was just, they're just cool projects. You know what I mean? Like at that age, first off, you're just happy to be working. But then if you're blessed enough to work on a project that you really believe in, all the better. You know, you kind of train yourself to go to work, do the work, finish it, and then throw it away and not have any expectations. And I just got I was very, very fortunate. You know what I mean? I was very fortunate in that it was like I was the flavor of the month when all of these projects kind of occurred. So I feel really, really lucky.
I mean, you were also an incredibly gifted actor. I feel like I want to make sure I say that, you know?
Appreciate that. No, but we all, you know, we all were really, you know, we all were really, really good. And we, you know, we would watch each other and kind of jockey for position. And if this actor was working, then we knew we would be available for something else. But it was still, you know, a very a close knit, you know, community.
Yeah. Yeah, I think it's important that I want to say that I'm not disagreeing with you that there is a flavor of the month and there are systemic issues. I want to point out that you're really good too, like you're a good actor.
Thank you.
And I'm glad you brought up Rent because I want to play you something. Take a listen.
Mimi, I'm surprised. A bright and charming girl you hangs out with these slackers who don't adhere to deals. They make fun, yet I am the one attempting to do some good. Or do you really want a neighborhood where people piss on your stoop every night?
From the 1996 original Broadway soundtrack to the gigantic musical, biggest musical in the world, Rent, that is V. Bohem, featuring Taye Diggs as Benny. Tell me the emotions and tell me what you felt and what went through your mind when you were listening to that just then.
Oh man, so much. First, I was impressed that I was getting out. Those are some high notes. I don't think I could hit those notes right now. And then I pictured myself, and then it, you know, then you just you take that nice stroll down memory lane. That was what a special time. You know what I mean? I it was a trip. It was a trip, and I'm. Yeah, I'm so grateful.
Was it a special time just because of how big it got? Like, did it have a lasting impact on you?
No, that's the no offense to the work or the writing. No, just the relationships that were built. You know what I mean? You know, we all were young and new. We didn't know what we were doing. I thought that there was like the music was really, really cool, but weird. And, you know, I didn't know if people were going to be turned off with the whole AIDS thing. And it was just, you know, the older I'm getting, you know, the less I'm kind of surprised, you know, like I've experienced a lot. So not a lot comes my way that is new. And I remember back then, you know, so much was just, we didn't know what the hell we were doing, what it was going to be. We didn't know anything. And it was, and I missed that energy of like not knowing.
Do you have a story you can tell me about a moment where you realize like, this is not just going to work out, but it's going to happen in a big way?
I mean, if I'm being honest, I didn't know until it was actually happening, but I will tell you when there were two moments. The first moment was when I heard Idina Menzel sing her solo, because that was one of the last songs that Jonathan Larson wrote. And I remember we were rehearsing in like segments, and Idina was right before my segment and my song. And I remember listening outside the door and being like, oh my God, this is amazing. Take me for what I am, who I was meant to be. And if you give a damn, take me, baby, or leave me. That's amazing. And then singing Seasons of Love. That was, it's weird because it was like, it was a feeling of, this is really special. What's going to happen with it? You know what I mean? Because it wasn't like, oh, this is special, we're going to be a hit. It wasn't that, you know what I mean? Because it was so kind of emotional and hit us in a very deep way that we, you know, for me personally, I couldn't imagine, you know, it was just about what we were feeling in that song. I wasn't even thinking about how it would be received.
Would you go back to Broadway?
Oh, 100%. 100%. Yeah. Oh yeah. As soon as I have time. I'm a song and dance dude, so that's my first love. Yeah.
Good, cuz I think you might be able to get that feeling there, you know. You might still be able to get that kind of feeling there, you know.
I hope so. Have children provide that. I have no idea what my son is going to say or do at any given point in time. So
they give you that feeling. Let's go back to the best man for a second. So, okay. I mean, I know this is a big question to end on, but I think it's worth asking given, I mean, how generous you've been in this conversation. If you look back at those early days in The Best Man, if you look back on those early days on Broadway to who I'm talking to right now, like, do you feel like a different person?
100%. 100%. And if I'm being honest, it makes me a little bit sad, only because and I've had a great life, but it's a life, you know, and I've been beaten down, and you know, I'm wiser, I know more. But unfortunately, you know, in order to become wiser and knowing more, you gotta go through some tough times. And I remember when I was younger, I was so much lighter, you know what I mean? But you know, that's, it is what it is. That's, you know, being young and then getting older, but I'm definitely 100% different. Yeah.
Well, it's a joy to get to watch you in this show again. And it's a joy to get the chance to talk to you and reflect on some of this. And you give me so much to think about in terms of the industry and just in terms of like what a career looks like in the arts. I really appreciate you making the time for us today.
Thank you. Thank you. I had a great time. Thank you, my man.
That was my conversation with the actor Taye Diggs. You can catch him on his new series, The Best Man, The Final Chapters, which is airing right now on the W Network in Canada. coming up on the show, I love this story. Cliff Cardinal sort of fooled audiences into thinking they were going to see a Shakespearean play. They didn't. And now him fooling the audience has been turned into its own show. I'll tell you the full story after this.
Favorite one-hit wonder.
Or that overpriced toy your parents would never let you have.
Or that TV show that no one else remembers because it was canceled way too soon. Now what if we could fix it? I'm Francesca Ramsey.
And I'm DeLon Grant. And after 20 years of friendship, we are now hosting a new nostalgia podcast called Let Me Fix It.
Each episode, we'll dig into our favorite celebrities, shows, and brands of yesteryear, and then imagine what it would take to repackage them for relevance today.
Think of our show as an intervention, but with way less stakes.
So subscribe to Let Me Fix It wherever you get your favorite podcasts.
I hope that people can come and take an experience that's not on their own terms and listen to somebody else for a while and hopefully be able to laugh at all of us and themselves as well.
There's a key part of that clip you just heard that I want you to pay attention to. Taking in something that's not on your own terms. I'm Tom Power. You're listening to Q. So let me tell you the story. About 2 years ago, Cliff Cardinal invites audiences to come see like a classic play. He invites them to see what he calls a radical retelling of William Shakespeare's As You Like It. So crowds pack into the theater and they're ready, you know, to see your average Shakespearean work. And then when they got there, they see something very, very different.
The RCMP is investigating the Catholic Church. That's like if Ross committed a murder and Rachel was sent to investigate. Jason Kenney said you can't cancel history. I say, history's been canceled a long time, Jay. It's time to schedule a history class.
So what you're hearing there is Cliff Cardinal pulling kind of a bait and switch. Instead of Shakespeare, the audience in the theater realizes that what they're watching is this really provocative one-man show, which is in itself this very urgent monologue about Canada's relationship with Indigenous people. So Cliff Cardinal's show is back on stage right now. It's called The Land Acknowledgement, or As You Like It. It's happening in Toronto, and the bait-and-switch part has been taken away. So what happens now? Here's my conversation with Cliff Cardinal. How are you?
Hey, thanks for having me, Tom. Hi, all of Canada.
are you, in all seriousness, a Shakespeare person at all?
No, not really. It never had any relevance to me, but I did like Station 11.
Oh, yeah. It's, there's apocalyptic Shakespeare is your thing. I understand.
Yeah.
Talk to me a little bit about what happened. So, like, the original kind of thought behind the show. So, like, 2,000 people show up. To see
well,
as
they
you
did,
like
they
it.
Didn't all they did they didn't all show up at once. they showed up over the course of like an 8-week run, and yeah, people saw a show that they didn't pay for, and you know the idea I guess was that this people shouldn't be so predictable, and people shouldn't assume that we know each other so well. We don't. You know, you read one article and then you think that you understand the Indigenous community. And if you're going to stand up and give some kind of land acknowledgement, you should back that up with some sort of footing and some sort of relationship.
Yeah.
So it was an invitation to people who go see Shakespeare audiences to have a relationship, maybe not with the Indigenous community, but at least with me.
Yeah. So so people are thinking they're coming to come see As You Like It. They're going to come see a Shakespearean play. You walk out on stage, it looks like you're going to give the land acknowledgement that audiences are sort of used to at the beginning.
And the land acknowledgement goes on a little long.
When did it start to clue in that people weren't going to get to see William Shakespeare's As You Like It?
At different places for different people, but eventually I do open the curtains and say, hey, this was all crap. I've never even read As You Like It.
So there's, let me just say this because this podcast is not just for Canada. It's for like, it's for people around the world. For people who don't know, a land acknowledgement is this sort of statement at the start of an event. It happens a lot in Canada. It reminds the audience that they're gathering on land that is the traditional territory of Indigenous people. And they got a land acknowledgement that ended after 85 minutes.
Yeah, that's right. I'm supposed to just come out and read this little piece of paper and everyone gives themselves a good pat on the back. And then the Shakespeare play begins. And that just seems really insincere to me.
It's insincere to you. Tell me more about that.
Well, how does someone with no footing in the indigenous community read a few lines and then stand there like they're John Trudell? I think that they don't go far enough, that either it's completely rote and means nothing, or someone has a really strong standing within the indigenous community or a really strong relationship. And at that point, it starts to feel a little weird, because people who really are part of our community generally don't feel like they have to raise their hand and say, look at me, you know, give me my Nobel Peace Prize.
What was the reaction from the people in the theater who thought they were going to get Shakespeare that night?
Well, there's this real tension in the audience, because people are kind of thinking, does he know he can't do that? And I found that it's better if I have a fight with somebody. If someone has a problem with something and they start grumbling, it's better if I just address it and we get it out in the open. And people see that conflict that I have with this patron, you know, really solidifies why we're doing this, why it was important to lie to people to bring them into the theater, to be a part of this affronting message. And generally, at that point, people kind of realize and want to come on board with the rest of it. Although we've had a wide, you know, range of reactions. People would, you know, get up and they would call me a disgrace, and then they'd leave and write a bunch of stuff on the subreddit.
Are you serious? Now that you're telling the truth?
Oh yeah, for sure. Oh, absolutely. It's pretty punk rock. And at this point, I'm used to it. So it became part of the show. It's actually a better show when I do have a conflict with an angry rich person.
And the I think from what I heard, like you mentioned, 2,000 people, not all at one time, came to the show, and only 9 asked for a refund. That's got to feel pretty good, right?
Yeah, I think that feels pretty good. And I think more people wanted their money back, but the social, you know, pressure was too much.
People were too afraid to go ask what for the symbolic meaning of what it would mean to try to get a refund.
It's the symbolic meaning for sure.
So early on in your show, you make it very clear that, as you mentioned, you're not a fan of land acknowledgements. Let's just take a listen to this.
They asked me to do the land acknowledgement today. I hate land acknowledgements. You want me to come up here with my feathers and my beads, bless your little event, tell you you're woke? So I said I'd be delighted. I'm afraid that people of money and privilege hear a land acknowledgement, nod solemnly in approval, and then wait patiently for their show to begin. Which, by the way, is what's about to happen to you.
I love nod patiently in approval and then wait for the show to begin. Can you talk a little bit more about that? So as you say, you are a fan of land acknowledgements now?
Well, I am now. Yeah, look, I'm on cue with Tom Power. They've been a great thing in my life. And they've also been, I think, they've probably been a positive thing in some of the lives of my friends who are Indigenous artists. I think that we are thrust into conversations that we might not have been a part of otherwise. And so there is something positive about it. But it's just that I haven't nominated anyone for an award because I thought they gave a swell land acknowledgement.
Is the show different now that there's no ruse, that people come in kind of knowing that they're going to watch this thing? They're not going in expecting Shakespeare and getting their minds changed?
Yeah, it's not so confrontational. Because, you know, people would show up and they'd be patrons of the theater. They see their name on the seats in front of them. That's where they always sit. And so for me to come and just take the privilege away from them was really violent for some people. And this way, you know, you're paying for the privilege to see the show. So it's fundamentally a different experience, although there's still some surprises along the way.
Is there any, like, change in you? Like, I would imagine that when you're on stage in those early shows, it's either maybe a little bit nerve-wracking or a little bit exciting, kind of knowing that everyone in the audience is expecting one thing and you're going to give them another.
It's pretty exciting to pull this on people,
yeah,
for sure.
Yeah.
You know, but the other thing is that comedy is really hard. You know, it's its own art form that people dedicate their entire lives to.
Yeah.
And I just jumped up one day and started telling jokes. And so, like, I'll tell you, there were some lonely nights where people didn't laugh. And I just, you know, we just went to a dark place. And so, you know, one day I was driving home and I saw this poster or this billboard of a comedian that I don't like that much. and maybe I've even made fun of on a certain occasion.
Yeah.
And I thought about that and I felt so small that that guy makes people laugh every night.
Yeah.
You know, he does the job. He earns people's money.
Yeah.
And for me to have gone through a whole night where people just look at me and they're offended and they're upset, you know, like it's not the way that I want to, you know, talk to people. And so, you know, luckily I got enough chances, you know, with Crow's Theater, who we went on a tour. We've done about 100 performances now, that we have a relatively good chance of affecting the audience the same way.
Yeah, I hear what you're saying there. And like now that the audience is sort of knows what they're in for, they're more willing to laugh. They're more willing to give that response that you're looking for than maybe they were before.
I hope so. Look, no one wants to laugh if I doubt the privilege that allows them to sit in that seat, or, you know, and to drive up in the Mercedes and to drive back to the mansion. You know, no one thinks that's funny.
Yeah.
When I call into question, you know, who pays for that? But I think that I hope that people can come and take an experience that's not on their own terms. Get outside of their own little myopic view of the world and listen to somebody else for a while, and hopefully be able to laugh at all of us and themselves as well.
Can we talk more about comedy? So I heard you were like a Richard Pryor guy and like a George Carlin guy growing up.
I love those guys. Yeah.
When did you first get introduced to them?
I was 13 years old, and this kid had stolen a CD from his older brother of George Carlin's Back in Town, and I could not believe he was saying those things.
Why is it that most of the people who are against abortion are people you wouldn't want to fuck in the first place? Boy, these conservatives are really something, aren't they? They're all in favor of the unborn. They will do anything for the unborn. But once you're born, you're on your own.
And that to me was the fundamental part of what makes stand-up comedy really exciting to me, is when the comic is kind of vibrating at this frequency where you're going, I can't believe he's saying that stuff. And Richard Pryor was for me, was more like the storytelling. And of course, you know, viciously funny and satirical, but the story, the way he could bring you to a time and a place with the character, or with just a line, or with just a, you know, an inflection, really merged what I love about storytelling with the vicious kind of attack of George Carlin.
And when you first started doing comedy, was that the kind of stuff you were doing right off the bat?
Yeah, absolutely. And I seem to love to go into really dark places, you know, things that are scary and things that are painful, and to try to laugh in the face of those kinds of things.
Why?
And it's not every Indigenous person will feel the same way as this, but I think it is because I'm Indigenous, because, you know, I'm inside of a community that carries a lot of trauma with it.
Yeah.
And, you know, my family, we love to make each other laugh, and we don't, you know, it's not about taking our minds off of it. It's laughing in the face. So, you know, you always run the risk of, not just offending, but hurting people. You know, you can hurt people's feelings, not like a brick in the face, but, you know, you can touch parts of people that are traumatized. And so, you know, it's dangerous to go into those places, but those are the most satisfying places for me, and not just my own work, but to view other comics.
You mentioned your family there. Your mom is the beloved actor Tantu Cardinal. We had her in on the show to talk about Falls Around Her. I think we had her on for that.
Yeah, Darlene Naponce's movie.
I'm Anishinaabe, Keith. Not Indian. Everybody loves Indians. Most just don't want to see him have a home. Or a voice.
Yes. Hey, remember you said you would come back?
I never said that.
She was on with, she was in Dances with Wolves. She was on North of 60. What do you remember growing up with a working actor mom?
I remember that she traveled a lot. But you know what happened was, I have a disagreeable temperament, and didn't really get along very well.
No.
And so, and so I dropped out of high school when I was 15 years old, and I walked into the back of this bar, and, it was a theater company that was performing, or they were rehearsing Canadian history plays.
Yeah.
It was video, they're called Video Cabaret, and they were back in the back of the Cameron House at that time.
In Toronto.
Yeah. And after a couple of days, the director kind of realized that I was showing up and said, if you're asked to do anything, best to do it. Otherwise, just stay out of the way. And so my 10th grade year was spent just listening to these actors performing theater. And any time I might have failed or fallen, it was artists who came and surrounded me. And that's what my mom offered to me.
So hold on. So how do you go from doing plays in the back of the Cameron House to sort of wanting to write your own work and perform your own work on a bigger level?
You know what? I really wanted to be a movie star. But apparently, Canada, you don't want me to be your movie star.
I don't believe you. Tell me the truth.
No, that's the truth. I just never got any breaks. I never got a single job off an audition. And I found that my time was better spent writing. So I stopped going to auditions and I started writing solo shows that would really feature me as a performer.
And what did you like about those? Like, what did those give you?
It's hard to say, really. The solo thing, it's like just you either have narcissistic trauma that makes you a solo artist, or it's not for you at all. And my first show was called Huff. It's about Indigenous kids who abuse solvents and are at high risk of suicide. And we toured that I still tour that, and we've done it over 200 times. And it really taught the craft of acting on the stage to me in a way that I wouldn't have gotten trying to audition as the third spear carrier at Stratford.
It scratched the itch that wouldn't have that may not have scratched.
Yeah, that's right.
Did you?
Oh, by the way, I just like to say to anyone at the Stratford Company, I've got this great adaptation of William Shakespeare's As You Like It. I think it's right up your alley.
You know what? Whatever you do, don't listen to the beginning of this. If you're just tuning in, don't listen to the beginning of this interview, and maybe think about hiring me for Shakespeare's As You Like It. I know about Huff, and I know that with Huff and with this show, The Land Acknowledgement, they're not quite solo shows, Cliff, because there's a lot of audience interaction in there.
That's very true. You know, it's the audience is the one who tells you, if they're open to dripping their imagination onto these places that you want them to, or if they're not. Or if I lose them. And so you have to be really conscious of that.
What does that energy feel like in the room when you are getting that audience interaction?
When it's working, it's, oh my gosh, it feels like when my mom would come home when I was a little kid.
What do you mean?
Well, look, I happen to know why I'm a writer. And it's because my mom is an actress. She traveled around a lot, and she was in some of the worst shows that ever lived.
Oh, yeah?
Like my mom was in Dr. Quinn, Medicine Woman. Do you know what I'm saying? So she did what it took to feed her children.
Yeah.
And that's hard when you're delivering bad material. Like, not every day was Dances with Wolves, So, but what made her happy the time when she would walk on air is when she'd been working on good writing. It just made it for her. So, the way my chemical brain is formed, I think, is because I'm trying to write something so good so that my mom won't have to leave.
So what you're saying is when you are on stage interacting with the audience and the audience gives you something back and the energy's feeling right, it feels like your mom is home because she has the right kind of words. It has the right kind of creative spirit.
Yeah, I like the way I said it better, though.
if I don't say it back to you, I don't make any money. See, that's the thing.
Oh, okay. So, yeah, that's no, but actually, in all seriousness, I think you did say it very well.
I appreciate it, Cliff. Are you exhausted after the show?
I'm exhilarated.
Really?
I'm exhilarated after the show. Yeah, I mean, like, I told my experience. I shared my expression with people who were there for it. That's why I'm here. And when I can actually do the thing that I love the most, which is being on stage and sharing with an audience, then I'm feeling great.
It's something very punk rock about the whole thing.
Oh yeah, man. I don't give a fuck, man.
You know what I mean, though.
Yeah, I'm done shutting up. You know, like I'm gonna say something. That's, you know, the other thing I loved about Carlin is that's like, man, you can say something if you want to, and you can find an audience for people who want to hear what you have to say, and it's pretty wild to have made it to Mervish Productions this month.
What do you love? I mean, because it's not just plays that you do. You're also in a band called, is it Cliff Cardinal and the Skylarks?
That's right. Yeah, our new song "Suicidal Valentine" made it to number 6 on the Indigenous Music Countdown.
What do you get? I know this is a big question, but I think you have an answer. What do you get, in honest to God, and not money, what do you get out of standing on a stage in front of people like that? What does it bring you?
It's, I can't say money?
No.
Okay.
I've watched too many of your interviews for you to say money.
Okay, to be able to share my voice and to share my little corner of the Canadian experience, and for the audience who is listening now or sees one of my shows, that they made my stories, one of my songs, my name, part of their human experience in the brief time that they walked on this planet, it means the world to me. It means the world to me that I'm part of that.
Cliff, nice to meet you.
Man, it's fun to meet you too.
Cliff Cardinal's show, The Land Acknowledgement, or As You Like It, is running at the CAA Theatre in Toronto until April 2nd. Here's Cliff Cardinal and his band, The Skylarks. This is a song called Suicidal Valentine. Cliff Cardinal and his band, The Skylarks, and Suicidal Valentine. Cliff Cardinal's show, The Land Acknowledgement, or As You Like It, is playing at the CAA Theater in Toronto until April 2nd. That is it for us today. If you want to get in touch with the show, please do. q@cbc.ca is the best way to do that. I'm on Instagram generally in the evenings now. I got it turned off for most of the day. I'm trying that out. But you can get in touch with me there. I'm at Tom Joe Power. The show is at CBCQ. Tomorrow on the show, Bill Nye will be here. Bill Nye, comedian, engineer, TV host, science guy. Decades after his TV show made a generation of kids fall in love with science, Bill has a lot to say about how we can reach out to skeptics. See you then, later on.
For more CBC podcasts, go to cbc.ca/podcasts.